Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Markowitz. We are your hosts for this weekend show, also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and our podcast, Corlin Economics Report. We every day are commentating on the markets and interviewing companies that have either caught your attention, all of our listeners, or caught our attention due to some of the recent news that has come out. Now, in this weekend show, we're really going to focus on companies here because, look, fact of the matter is, when you're looking at the precious metals, especially sector, the market's been pretty slow and it's been a tough market. We've commentated a lot on different technical levels to watch, and unfortunately, at least in the near term, stuff hasn't changed all that much. So I think it's the most important thing, especially at the end of the year here, to look into companies that might be on your shopping list, companies that are on our shopping list, because of the fact that, look, it really does feel like a lot of these resource companies and resource stocks are on sale, but unfortunately, they've been on sale almost all year. We're kicking off the show with Robert Sinn, also known as Goldfinger, over at CEO.ca. Now, Robert, we bring you on the show on a regular basis to commentate on the markets and also the companies. And again, we're going to be focusing on the companies and on an article that you released back at the tail end of November. November 26th, you entitled this article, Goldfinger's 2021 Tax Loss Silly Season Shopping List. Now, you outline, I believe it's 5 or 6 companies within this article. We'll get to those companies, but first, let me ask you, look, it feels like every explorer is down 70% this year, or at least from their highs of 2020. What isolates certain companies for you to say, this one's better than the other one, even though they have all pulled back?
Hey, Corey. Yeah, thanks for inviting me on to talk about the tax loss silly season shopping list. Yeah, I put out that article a couple of weeks ago, actually the day after Thanksgiving. The market was getting hit very, very hard on that Friday. And, you know, yeah, a lot of companies are down big in 2021 in the gold and silver sector, especially among the juniors. And so, yeah, I wrote in the article, actually the first paragraph, I started with like 20 different possibilities, candidates, you know, for this list. And I had to narrow it down to 6. And it wasn't an easy process. It wasn't easy to make these choices. But some things that I did focus on were quality of management teams. All 6 of these companies have strong management teams with CEOs that I have confidence in. Most of them are not, except for Angold, which just announced the financing, a small $2 million financing, you know, with the exception of Angold, none of them has to raise money this second. They could all wait 3, 4, 5, 6 months down the road, raise money, hopefully under better market conditions, maybe after they put out some good news, right? And then another thing is that these companies are not really old, expired cartons of milk. Most of them are relatively new to the market. A few of them launched either in late 2020 or early 2021 amid high expectations. Like with the case of Angold and Outback in particular, when these companies started trading, sentiment in the sector was much stronger and they kind of came to market at pretty high valuations. And so that was a ripe set up for, you know, disappointment. Obviously, new company, high expectations, relatively high market valuation. And then you have this year of 2021 where gold and silver kind of trend sideways to lower, and companies are struggling to complete drill programs on time, and the labs are super slow in bringing back the results from drill programs. And so that's just created this perfect storm where, you know, companies like Outback and Angold are down big, very, very big year to date, and certainly from their all-time highs. You know, with Angold, it was at 53 cents at one point early in the year, recently traded down to about 12 cents. With Outback, it was above a dollar at one point earlier in the year, and it's trading about 21, 22 cents right now. So we've seen some really big haircuts here, and the valuations and the negativity around many of these companies make them attractive to me, actually.
So let's get into some of these companies. You've already mentioned Angold and Outback. We will dive a bit more into those, but I do want to start off with one of the larger companies within this list, Elevation Gold Mining. Now, this company also used to be known as Northern Vertex Mining. That's when Eclipse Gold Mining and Northern Vertex came together. They recently rebranded into Elevation Gold Mining. They are traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol ELVT and on the OTC market under the symbol EVGDF. Now, this company is a production company. They have the Moss Mine up and running that is cash flowing for them. They also see some growth potential around there. And they also have this Hercules asset, that one, more of an exploration play that came from Eclipse. What do you like about this company? Where do you see the catalyst coming from?
I would say Elevation is probably the most hated one on this list of all the six companies. It has a lot of negativity around it, it seems. A lot of people are very sour, especially with the chart going from basically $3 to under a dollar now. You know, we're at 84 cents, making a new low. As we have this conversation, the market cap is $51 million in Canada, which, as you said, this is an operating mine in Northwest Arizona, 30 to 40,000 ounces of gold output per year. It's heap leach, you know, near surface, you know, oxide gold. I was at the mine in May of this year, and I really like the operations. I like the location of the project near infrastructure in a great mining trend, the Walker Lane trend of Northwestern Arizona. You know, you're a 2-hour drive from Vegas, 3 or 4 hour drive from Phoenix, lots of high quality skilled mining labor in the area. So there's a lot of things to like about that. You know, what's not to like, I guess? Well, I guess what's not to like is that it's obviously higher cost. You know, we're talking about $1,300 to $1,400 all-in cost on those gold ounces. So not a low-cost mine by any stretch. And obviously, part of that higher cost is the scale. You know, 30,000 ounces is not a huge mine, right? And so the opportunity here is to get Moss up to something like 45 or 50,000 ounces a year and add some scale to it and try to get that all-in cost down back under $1,200. And so they're working on that. There's a new, you know, leach pad that was just built, and they're adding ounces with the, you know, drill bit. Every month or two, the company puts out more results, and they continue to drill this resource out. And you know, you talk to the company, you know, Mike Allen, the CEO, he's pretty confident they have over 1 million ounces there at Moss. And it's just going to take time to prove that. But if you think about, let's say they do get the output up to 40 to 45,000 ounces a year, and there is 1 million ounces there, you've got a pretty long mine life there. And then that's not even talking about the Hercules project that you mentioned. And then also all the exploration potential at Moss. This is a huge property package, and the mine area and the mine infrastructure is a very small, like, postage stamp size footprint on this property package. Lots of sexy drill targets there. If you read the article that I wrote, I mentioned Florence Hill. So this is they're going to drill that in Q1. And actually, I am really excited about that target. I think the Florence Hill area could be a new discovery in the making. Obviously, we have to drill it. We need to see the you know results, but the market's not giving them any credit for any of that stuff. So I like it. Obviously, I've been wrong so far as it continues to trend lower, but this is a pretty damn good opportunity in my estimation, sub $1 per share.
Well, Robert, just along the topic here of Elevation Gold Mine. And full disclosure, I'm also a shareholder of Elevation. I was involved when it was Northern Vertex before the merger with Eclipse. And honestly, I wasn't impressed with the merger, just to be completely transparent, because I didn't understand why they were buying an asset that was so earlier stage when they could have bought a producing asset or something that was already further along that could feed their development pipeline. But what I always saw was the opportunity around Moss to expand the mine and to expand the mine life. Do you like that kind of a model where they have that upside exploration potential to feed the production, and they're not really getting credit for it right now because they're only being looked at in a vacuum as to what they produced last quarter as opposed to where this could grow? Or do you like that they have this other Hercules project, this complete blue sky upside that they're almost getting zero credit for? What angle do you like more, the production growth aspect or the exploration side of this?
You know, that's a great question, Chad. And I wrote that in my article that it's tricky when you put a small mine asset, you know, fully permitted mine, but a relatively small one, like 30,000, 35,000 ounces of gold output per year is not going to set the world on fire. It's not, you know, it's very limited in what sort of evaluation you can get on that, right? So I actually like this company more for the exploration upside, to be completely honest. And so whether it's, you know, Hercules or at some of the targets that they have, those, you know, to the south at Moss, the one I mentioned at the, you know, Florence Hill, I think that's really where the big upside is here. Now, obviously, if they can fine tune their mining operations and lower costs a bit and increase output, that's going to be great. But I think that to really get this up to $150 or $200 million market cap again, or in the future, you know, we're going to need to see some new exploration hits, some big hits on step out targets. So that's why I'm actually excited to see them move a rig or two to some of those exploration targets at Moss.
Okay. In full disclosure, I am also a shareholder of Elevation Gold Mining. I came over from the Eclipse side of that transaction, but you know what? They do have production. They are cash flowing and there is exploration upside, but boy, oh boy, that stock has definitely been crushed this year. Let's move on to Angold Resources then. Traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol AAU. Also on the OTC markets under the symbol AAUGF. This company holds a handful of projects. The main project, the Iron Butte project in Nevada. They also hold two projects in Chile, as well as the Uchi project in Ontario, Canada. What do you like about Angold here, Robert?
Well, you know, honestly, Corey, I think the thing I like most about Angold is the management team. You know, this is a top-notch, you know, management team. I like the CEO. They have Doug Ramshaw and Michael Connor as advisors to the company. A very strong team there. And honestly, in junior mining, the most important aspect of a junior mining company is typically the management team. A bad management team can, you know, ruin shareholder value with the best projects out there. And a strong management team can take, you know, mediocre projects and advance them and make value for shareholders. And so I like Angold for that. The valuation at what, 11, 12, 13 million market cap in Canada. That's barely more than a Shell valuation. And as you mentioned, they have an extensive project portfolio, four different projects, South America, Canada, and the U.S. The main focus is the project in the, you know, U.S. near the Battle Mountain trend. And basically what you have there is you have a historic resource near surface, you know, sort of oxide, resource of more than 600,000 ounces. But the idea, the concept is it's a low sulfidation epithermal system that has not been drilled to depth. So while there has been work done on the project, it has been drilled historically. And, there's this 600,000 ounces at about 2/3 of a gram that's been outlined near surface. That's probably not going to set the world on fire by itself. What you need is you need to get that over 1 million ounces, and hopefully above 2 million ounces and find some higher grade gold at depth. And so that's what Angold's going to be doing early in the new year. They will drill this project to depth to try to find the boiling zone, the higher grade sweet spot of this system. And they've been doing the work that you need to do to optimize your drill targeting. Because, like, you know, a lot of investors would just love to see companies put a million holes in the ground and let's keep drilling. But it's very expensive, especially in this part of the world, the southwest of the, you know, U.S., a big mining area, lots of projects being drilled out down there. And it's very expensive. Diamond core drilling, $350 a meter, $400 a meter in some areas. You can burn through a treasury very quickly by just trying to drill 400 meter holes all over the place, right? So they've been doing the work that they need to optimize the you know, drill targeting, and so that we will get that maiden program, the Diamond Core program, early in 2022.
Well, Robert, on a company like Angold, and it doesn't have to just be Angold, but it could be any project like this where it's a relatively new explorer. They've got their flagship with Iron Butte, but they've also got the four projects. And as you just outlined, it's expensive just to drill the one project. So sometimes investors don't put much value into the other two or three projects, and companies are left with few choices, either to leave them on the shelf or to sporadically go down and drill them. Or sometimes they'll bring in a JV partner and option part of those other projects out just to move those along. Sometimes they eventually will spin those projects out if the other project goes primary. How do you value the overall explorer when, you know, clearly most of the action is where they're drilling and on the flagship? And then the other question would be, because of those expenses you just outlined, do you want them to get the value from the market where they hit those higher grade zones, and that's usually what's going to increase the valuation of Explorer? Or do you want to see them making measured progress to get it to that million ounces and get economic studies on and move it down the development pipeline? Sometimes in that development pipeline, companies kind of go stale as well. So what do you think the main driver for a company like Angold with so many different projects and so many different
businesses? With Iron Butte, it's pretty clear to me that the near surface resource that they have, 600,000 ounces or so, is not probably not enough to be economic. It's not enough to make this project valuable by itself. It's a very nice starting point, though, because if they can expand that resource, you know, along strike at depth and find some higher grades, then suddenly you really have something in basically the best state for mining in the U.S., you know, very attractive location for, you know, a gold mining project. So I think that's why they need to drill this, and that's the priority right now. That's quite clear. But you're right, it's four projects across two continents. That's a tall order for $12 or $13 million, you know, junior. So yeah, it's challenging. I think that what companies have to do is they have to steadily advance each project and figure out what the market actually really wants to see. Because at the end of the day, you're at the whim of the market. You're going to have to come back to the market to raise capital, to continue to do exploration work. And so you need to figure out what the market wants to see. And I think Angold has figured out what the market wants to see. We want this project drilled early in 2022. And then based upon the results of that drilling, they'll know what to do. If they drill 10 dusters and there's no boiling zone to be found, then focus on South America or Canada, right? If we hit the boiling zone and we hit 20 meters of 30 grams, then all systems go on this. And it's very clear what your flagship is then, right?
That is true. I think the company has done work on most of these, maybe all of these projects that they hold. And it seems like they are just waiting for the market and the drill bit to tell them which one they really need to go after. But all of these projects have shown some indication of mineralization. So, yeah, who knows? We followed along with them and we will be following back up with them. But it has been a tough year for Angold, just like a few of these other stocks we're going to talk about. Next one being Outback Goldfields. You mentioned this at the onset. Now, this company is traded on the CSE under the symbol OZ, also on the OTC market under the symbol OZBKF. Now, I am a shareholder of this company as well. And look, they came out of the gate not that long ago at the very beginning of this year. And unfortunately, it's been under a lot of pressure. A lot of that being because the company has four projects in the Victorian goldfields of Australia. Australia went through a pretty harsh lockdown. So the company was handcuffed in terms of the work they could do throughout this year on those projects. What do you like about Outback? What has your interest here?
Well, Corey, kind of like with Angold, I like the management team. I like the CEO. I think he's a great person to have at the helm who really knows this business backwards and forwards. They have a good advisor team, a good board. And then you have four projects, as you mentioned, in a prolific area of gold mining in Australia, right? And so Outback came to market at the end of 2020, amid a bit of fanfare and optimism. I think it had at one point a 60 or 65 million market cap, which is a pretty chunky market cap for an early stage, explorer, right? These are all pretty early stage projects that haven't had a lot of work done on them. Great location, and clearly a lot of smoke, but obviously a lot of work on the ground, whether it's soil sampling or mapping or IP surveys or, what have you, all this ground, all this pre-drilling work that has to be done to set the stage for a successful diamond core program. And so the company's been doing a lot of that work in 2021, and obviously the market wants to see drill results. And the market is very impatient for drill results. And they actually had a drill program that was supposed to happen in June at one of their projects that got pushed back. And so that will happen early in the new year. I like the management team. I think the valuation is pretty damn cheap here. And all they need to do is have one of these four projects be a winner, hit some good intercepts, and it's going to be worth a hell of a lot more than $13 or $14 million, market valuation. One of the projects that probably helped to get it such a hot start at that $60 million market cap is called, Silver Spoon. And that's near Kirkland Lake Gold's Fosterville mine. It's literally adjacent to it. So you can imagine, if your claims are bordering on one of the highest grade, most profitable gold mines in the history of the world, it's pretty sexy, and it's going to get the market's attention. It's going to get people's attention. They're going to want it to be drilled, right? And so we will see Outback drill Silver Spoon in mid-2022. And honestly, purely from a trading standpoint, so let's forget about long-term investing, what Outback is ultimately going to be worth 5 years from now. Just from a trading standpoint, if you're buying the stock here, which by the way, I am, and by the way, I own all the shares of the companies that we're talking about in this conversation, if you're buying it at 20 cents a share down from a dollar, just as the new year turns and anticipation builds for that maiden, drill program at Silver Spoon next to Fosterville, the Fosterville gold mine, the share price could easily just double on anticipation of that first program at Silver Spoon. The market hasn't cared about Silver Spoon in 2021 because they weren't planning to get out there yet, but they will in mid-2022.
Well, Robert, I got to ask on this one because I'm trying to think of questions that could also apply to everybody else in their portfolio of explorers. This is clearly an area play, this whole area of Victoria near the Fosterville mine. There are probably a half dozen new exploration companies drilling around them. Three or four of them are adjacent to the Fosterville mine, and they all outline that in their corporate presentations. One of their neighbors and one of the neighboring explorers hit a big hole this year, and it sent it screaming up. Do you think that gives it some added zest when it's in these area plays? So whether it's the Pilbara, whether it's Timmins, whether it's the Golden Triangle, in this case, this near this Fosterville mine that Kirkland Lake had, do you think that area play just by default gets more eyeballs? So if they do hit something near that property, it's just going to get more traction. Is that part of the angle as well?
I mean, absolutely. This is an area of Australia where more than 80 million ounces of gold has been pulled out of the earth. And obviously Fosterville, with its grades of what, 20, 25 grams per ton gold, multi-million ounce, you know, mine that's made huge profits for Kirkland Lake. Yeah, I mean, if you hit a hot intercept like E79 did, you know, earlier this year, you hit something like 100 grams plus over, you know, 5, 6, God forbid, 10 meters, you know, this is going to just catch fire, right? It's going to be a huge, you know, it's going to be a huge gainer. You know, that's obvious, but you got to drill those holes. You got to actually do it. It's one thing to talk about and speculate like we are now. It's another thing to actually put out the, you know, results.
Yes, it is. And results are truly what do move stocks, especially in markets that we have been here where no one seems to be front running any drill results right now. Robert, before we get you out of here, we have time for one more company. You do have three more companies in this article, though, so I'm going to leave it up to you. Which one do you want to highlight before we wrap this up?
Well, Corey, I'd like to also say that Angold and Elevation are sponsors of Energy and Gold, a website that I write for. Let's talk about Vanstar. So they're not a sponsor of anything I'm affiliated with. I do own the stock. I've been buying it in the low 40s, and they have a 1/4 stake. So they own 1/4 of the, you know, Nelligan, you know, gold project in Chibougamau, Canada. So this is a 3.2 million ounce inferred resource at an average grade of 1.02 grams per ton gold. Their partner is IAM Gold. So that's a much larger gold mining company with mines in various places around the world. IAM Gold is more focused right now, it seems, on one of their gold mines in Africa. But they're still drilling at Nelligan. In fact, they just completed 10,000 meters there, and we'll get, you know, results from that program over the coming months. And IAM Gold plans to drill at least another 5,000 meters there in early 2022. So IAM Gold is advancing this project and clearly trying to expand that 3.2 million ounces to something more, 4 or 5 million ounces. And so you have to ask yourself, what is 1/4 of a multi-million ounce gold mine in a great area of Canada for mining worth, you know? And right now Vanstar is valued at about a 24, 25 million market cap on the venture. In my estimation, their interest in Nelligan is worth more than their entire current market cap. Now, you know, kind of something that we've discussed previously was, well, when you're a minority owner in a mining project and you're sort of at the whim of the major or the much larger company, it sometimes isn't so great for the shareholders of the junior. And I agree with that. But I have to think that the value here will be unlocked in one way, shape, or form over the next year or two. It's too valuable to have this project with 3.5 to 4 million ounces of gold in a great location with good infrastructure and very favorable for mining. And not have the value realized for Vanstar. And so we're not even talking about Vanstar's own wholly owned projects, which they have their own set of 4 or 5 early stage exploration projects in Canada. I'm just focusing on the, you know, Nelligan asset, not even mentioning they have 5 million cash in the treasury. It's worth more than their entire 25 million market cap. So I like my odds, and nothing is a sure thing in the market. That's for sure. There is risk, obviously, but I like my odds of buying here around 40, 42 cents a share and waiting for the company and the sector to come back in favor in 2022.
Robert, I was going to ask you about this kind of a company. I'm really glad you picked this one because it's a good case study for when there is a partial ownership in a project and one of the big boys has the remaining stake. Some investors really like that because it shows the larger company has vetted the project and believes in it and they've got a lot more wherewithal than most retail investors do to vet out, is this something they think is prospective? So from that standpoint, it's a huge plus for the company that they've partnered with one of the larger producers. But the other side of it is it's harder to value the company for exactly how you outlined it. You know, they only own a part of it. What's it worth? And then they're kind of at the whim of the larger company as far as how quickly they want to move it. Do you like to see the exit strategy more where the larger company buys that project from them and they keep those other projects going on the side? Or do you like to see it where they could be a potential takeover candidate from the larger company? And does that factor into your investment process, or is it strictly just the value you think the major will bring to that project over time?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky question, Chad. And I think that obviously if one company owns all of, you know, Nelligan, the valuation for the project would be more than when it's segmented where there's a three-quarter owner, a 70% owner, a 25% or 30% owner. And obviously, if you're the minority owner, you get punished a little bit for being the minority owner. You're not going to get that full valuation that you would normally get when you're the operator of the project. But I think in this case, Vanstar has something really valuable because they have a full carried interest. So this, they don't have to pay for any of the drilling or the feasibility study to advance this project to being a fully permitted mine. Only once it's permitted and they're pouring gold ounces does Vanstar have to start paying the bills for their ratio that they own. Also, something I didn't mention is that Vanstar has a 1% net smelter royalty on 8 of the Nelligan claims. So part of the project that will likely be mined at some point in the future, they have a net smelter royalty of 1% on it. So how much is that worth? I don't know. It could be worth $5 million someday. It might be worth more or less. I don't know. But there's a lot of value when you add it all up. And I think it's worth quite a bit more than the company's current market cap. And obviously, if IAM Gold chooses to do the feasibility study and then go through permitting and really advance this to being an operating mine, that value is going to be unlocked. It's just a waiting game. Is it going to take 3 years? Is it going to take 4 years? Is it going to take 5 years? You know, we don't know. But obviously, if that timeline starts to become more visible and we see the larger company really start to advance this, then I think the market really starts to pay more attention to Vanstar at that point.
All right, Robert, we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks for spending this really extended time frame with us to go through some of these companies that do have your attention into the end of the year. And again, look, it's been a rough year for a lot of these companies. We need some good news to come out of the companies. And we also just need generally better sentiment in the metals sector. Who knows, maybe that'll all come next year, but the best thing we can all do is simply keep an eye on the companies we like and I guess try to buy whenever we're comfortable with it. And again, hopefully the market can help out on the back end of those purchases. Robert, thank you as always for your time. Everybody, stick around. We're going to be right back to wrap up the weekend edition.
Thanks, Corey.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first few segments with Robert Sinn, where he went through some of the stocks that he is looking at the end of the year that in the resource sector, boy, oh boy, they all have sold off hard. In these next two segments, we're going to take a bit more of a big picture look at markets and a wide range of other sectors as we are chatting with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, that is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail side, Rick writes the In the Know Trader, and a piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs with the goal to beat the S&P. Rick, we're going to start off with U.S. equity markets because this week was really dominated by the Fed meeting and the Fed statement. And of course, on the back of that Fed statement, we got some almost contrary moves in a wide range of markets. And at the end of the week, if we're focusing on U.S. markets, it looked like the markets were going to be weak early on in the day on Friday. But as we're recording this, about halfway through the day, we're seeing the markets push back, take back a lot of those losses from earlier in the day. And they are very close to all-time highs. Just continues to be the narrative around these markets of any weakness seems to be bought. And as much as people want to get on the short side of that trade, well, markets bounce back very quickly. It's been the story of over a year. Rick, what's your assessment of these U.S. markets as we headed into the week, fighting back, taking back a lot of those losses and ending close to all-time highs?
Yeah, so Corey, this morning, interestingly, the market was down enough to make new lows on the week. And as you say now, the S&P is almost unchanged on the day after being down, I don't know, close to what, 50 points or so, something like that. The low today was 4,600, went right to, you know, that main figure. And now we're at 4663, so a huge bounce back. But this is kind of the volatility that you'd expect to have with the Omicron virus, with the fact that, you know, the Fed became much more hawkish earlier this week, and the market rallied after that news and then gave it all back. And now it's, you know, it's mid-range again, kind of for the week. It shows you that investors right now are somewhat confused in which way to play, and you're going to see these movements both ways. And my guess is just when you think you've really got a handle on which way the next trend is going to be, it's going to snap back in your face the other direction. I mean, it's very easy to get very bearish this morning. And now, you know, if you sold earlier in the day, you've got decent losses already of at least 1%. That happened very quickly. So it reminds me a bit of what we've seen previously this year. But also, if you go back to a year ago when COVID was hadn't quite spread globally yet, but we knew it existed kind of in China, it was starting to move around. People are replaying what's occurred over time in both directions and with the volatility that you expect, because ultimately you can say that the big COVID sell-off from March 2020 bottomed and we've had a huge rally since. So people think that, you certainly have enough people who think that at this point, whatever Omicron is going to do, it'll be somewhat short-term. We might get a pullback, but it's all going to be, you know, potential entry to get in on the long side again with another major rally coming. Those who know how much the market sold off last year before we made that bottom are saying, you know, from an S&P that keeps stalling just north of 4,700, and even this week inability to make new all-time high close or anything like that. So we made a new intraday high this week. But that same day that made that new intraday high closed on the low, just around down to 4,600. So we keep seeing these huge reversal type days. And to me, the most important level is 4,443 on Friday closes. As long as we stay above that level, it's about 220 points beneath where we are now. This bull market is fine and just, you know, expectedly erratic given a change in the Fed, given Omicron going into the winter and the fact that these viruses usually get worse in cold weather. And it is spreading like wildfire across the U.S. Significantly. And it is something where, you know, this virus is something we're going to have to continuously deal with. We had the COVID, then the Delta variant. Now we have the Omicron variant. And I'm no doctor. I can't tell you if this is the type of thing that is just one of many variants that are going to come, or if we get a handle on Omicron, is you know, that going to be kind of towards the end of things. I don't know. All I know is that this, the COVID virus and its related variants are here, and we've got to deal with it. Whatever your politics are, the reality is that this is a global situation. And when it comes to the markets, expect continued volatility as we go through the winter. I suspect that Omicron will get worse, and hopefully it's not as bad a a strain as Delta is, and we have to all live with it. But expect volatility into 2022. I don't see a sell off coming like we had in early 2020, don't be surprised if the markets, get knocked down every once in a while. But again, I'll reiterate, 44, 43 in the S&P to me is the key level. And as long as you stay above there on Friday closes, the bull market is still a bull market. Under there, I change my tune.
Yeah, Rick, for as much as COVID does impact these markets, it really just brings in fear here and there, but that fear seems to dissipate very quickly and markets seem to move back very quickly, or at least that's been the theme of this year. And you know what? A lot of eyes have been on the Fed, but there's one thing you've been pointing out to a lot of your subscribers that you think it's more about the bond market, more so credit spreads in terms of where the markets are going. This ties almost directly into just availability of money and funds for larger hedge funds, larger investors to put into the market. Why are credit spreads so important in your eyes, and what levels are you watching?
So credit spreads are kind of a generic term for the corporate bond market yields versus treasury market yields. And they widen out when you've got some concerns that affect the market. So for instance, the spread that I watch, which is the ICE Bank of America U.S. Corporate Index, OAS, option adjusted spread, reached just over 4% at the height of COVID mania back in early 2020. So the spreads between corporates, AAA corporates, and treasuries were over 4% at the height of the sell-off in stocks. They reversed as the bull market came back, or better said, as spreads came in, helping the bull market to fuel itself, because I do think credit spreads often give you the best clue before stocks are going to move of what the credit market thinks of the overall risk level in the marketplace. And traditionally on Wall Street, and a stock individual investors wouldn't know this, but the smartest money has always been said to be in the fixed income market. So looking at clues from the fixed income market, in this case, a credit spread, you get a very good sense of where the biggest players on the street, and realize that the fixed income side is as big as the stock market is. The fixed income side is huge, and people don't put on $250,000 position is the way a hedge fund, or even it could be multi-million-dollar position. On the credit side, these are huge positions that get placed by large institutions. So getting a sense of what they're thinking often is the price leader to what happens in the stock market. So this ICE Bank of America Corporate Index OAS spread that I look at had widened out to 4% in March 2020. It then quickly turned around, which gave a clue that excess liquidity and excess fear had changed on the fixed income side, and ultimately that helped fuel bottom out the stocks and help fuel the rally. That spread fell all the way down to as low as 86 basis points earlier this year. But before it hit 86 basis points, it rallied up on when stocks sold off in February and March, This spread had actually widened out to 104 basis points before ultimately making not only a cyclical low, but a secular low down to 86 bips. It double bottomed at 86 bips and then started moving up over the last month or so. So stocks have been sideways, but the spread started moving out, saying there's some concern, not big time, because we just a week ago or a week and a half ago, we got to the same 104 basis points that it had reached on the decline earlier this year. When stocks sold off, the credit spread had gotten up to 1.04%. We got there again a week and a half ago, and currently the data has a one-day lag. So as of yesterday, it's 101 basis points. If we get above 104 on the spread and stay above 104, that's a bad sign for stocks. And it doesn't mean we're going to get a big sell-off, but there's so much there's room up to 133 basis points before we'd have like kind of the next level of resistance. So it would imply if this spread breaks out above 104 and stays above 104 bips, then it would imply that you're going to see some pressure on stocks. So it doesn't, I'm not talking about a 10% decline or something, but it would imply that there's more fear on the credit side, and therefore that will likely precede a decline in stocks. So it is something to watch, and I suggest, you know, if your listeners can watch that themselves, it's just an additional clue to help give you a real sense of which way the stock market is likely going to go. So that's why I watch it.
The nice thing about that is it's a financial clue, right? Because as much as the Fed and COVID news can drive markets, there isn't a chart to judge any of that kind of stuff when it comes quite as straightforward as credit spreads. Let's also talk about the U.S. dollar, because the U.S. dollar, for as much negativity was around the dollar heading into this year, is actually having a pretty good year, and it is closing in on one of your targets here. The dollar currently right around 96.35 on the dollar index. Rick, let's start off with a big picture. Why were so many commentators wrong about the dollar this year?
I don't know what the impetus was to be that bearish, but as I've said to you and before on this show, it was the biggest global macro consensus trade coming into 2021 is that the dollar would fall apart. And the same time that as we were entering January of 2021, the models we use and place a lot of value on were suggesting that the dollar could likely bottom right then and there. So in my outlook for this year, I actually compared what I thought was going to happen this year in the dollar to what happened in 2017. So to go back to that just for a second, when Donald Trump won the election in November of 2016, the dollar ripped to the upside for the balance of the 7 weeks or so that were remaining in 2016. And it was expected that the dollar would rip higher into his presidency. So going into 2017, the biggest consensus global macro call across Wall Street was that the dollar would be very strong in 2017. That ended up being dead wrong, and the dollar peaked, made the high for 2017 on the very first trading day of the year. And it eroded the entire year to close on the low of 2017. So strategists on the street could not have been more wrong. We noticed that same thing coming into this year, but in reverse. We were getting buy signals at the same time that the global macro strategists were saying the dollar would be horrific this year. And we cautioned clients about listening to that and said, the risk is actually in being short the dollar. You want to be long the dollar. And if the pattern holds true, then 2021, the dollar index with, you know, 2 weeks to go or so of trading, will likely close on or near the high of this year. Again, making the bulk of the strategists as wrong as they could have been, because the dollar bottomed in 2021 in the first week in January.
and it has not been steadily higher all year, but it is significantly higher than where we started the year, which was down in the 89 handle for the dollar index, and now we're talking about almost 96.5. So a significant move in the way that analysts did not correctly anticipate. So I've been looking to actually fade this up move in between 96.5 to 98 in the dollar index. And we've gotten there over the last 3 weeks or so, multiple times we've gotten above 96.5 to sell off under 96. So for, you know, trading, it's been very good levels. It wouldn't surprise me if we get one more jolt higher into year end and close right near the highs. But I'd actually think that anywhere from roughly 96.5 up to about 98 or so is where I'm willing to fade the rally. I don't know yet what the largest macro call is right now and where they stand on the dollar. I can tell you, and we'll shift a little bit here, that crypto is actually right now, from what I can tell, the biggest consensus short for 2022. And just based on history, if that's the largest consensus short, my guess is they're not going to be right. Now, it doesn't mean crypto can't be down net-net in 2022, but it may be down minimally, or they could be very right or very wrong. If I had to guess which one of those three, I'd say they're probably wrong, and that there can be some weakness in crypto. We're already, you know, in Bitcoin terms, we're already in the mid 40,000s. It's off of a high in the upper 60,000s. So it's already had a, you know, a big correction. We got as low as, I think, 28,800 in the front month futures contracts on the sell-off we had earlier this year. And then we lifted up, you know, to new all-time highs from there. So I probably use the continued weakness in crypto to look to buy if you're looking for longer term returns. But look, Bitcoin does have a major double top in the mid to upper 60,000s. Ethereum has a major double top near the upper 3,000s to near 4,000. So you've got to be really a confirmed bull in crypto and kind of live through all these drawdowns if you're really thinking that Bitcoin's going $100,000 or more, you know, per coin, and that Ethereum's ultimately going to, you know, $10,000, which plenty of people think. So these are more kind of buy and close your eyes type ideas. They're, you know, hard to call them investments per se, but I guess in certain ways, if you really think that cryptocurrencies are going to be significant in the future, then yeah, you got to kind of buy them on weakness and close your eyes and be willing. And I say this, I've said it to every time I talk about crypto, no matter what group I'm talking to, whether it's at a conference, whether it's in an interview like this, you know, the media, whatever money you put into crypto, you have to be prepared to lose it all, and your life can't change it all. So if you're taking, if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you're putting a significant amount of money into crypto, I think that's a very foolish move. You've probably done decently so far, but of course it depends on where you got in. But crypto is a huge gamble. And, you know, whatever money I've put into crypto myself so far, if I lost it all, it's not going to change the way I live. It's not going to stop me from being able to pay bills. It's not going to stop me and my family from taking vacation, etc. It is kind of play money. And I picked a certain amount I was willing to potentially lose all of on the chance that, you know, I could make a 10 times return on my money over several years. And that's the way I look at it. So it's pure gambling type money. And I think that's the way most people should look at it, because despite what we know about it, we also know how much we don't know about it. And it's adopting, and will people actually pay with crypto, you know, down the road? Are you going to go into a Starbucks, buy a cup of coffee and pay with crypto? I kind of don't think so. I don't know how universally this would actually be used as compared to it being an investment, let's call it that, that is attached to the greater fool theory, meaning you buy it because you think somebody's going to pay more than you. We simply don't know. It has no inherent value. It's, you know, to me, it's still very much in the category of gambling. But I'm willing to take a very small portion of my overall portfolio and put it into the gamble.
So you're willing to gamble just a little bit. But I understand why, right? Yeah. It's volatile. And quite frankly, there has been a lot of money made in cryptos. I find it so fascinating and fun to follow along with. But you are right. If you're depending on that money for daily living expenses or even vacations.
Yeah. And look, I have a couple of friends who have been in, you know, Bitcoin from when it was 5,000 or less. And, you know, they've made 10 times their money. And that's great. But when I read that there are certain, and it tends to be people who are generally 35 and under, who have 50% or more of their investable dollars in crypto, you're certainly not thinking a heck of a lot about the future. You're trying to be the next Mark Zuckerberg or somebody, you know, you want to be the next billionaire. And to me, you want to take that chance? Fine, do it with, you know, a few percent of your portfolio and make money that way. But I don't know, maybe I'm too conservative. I'm just not going to put all my eggs in one basket and hope that, you know, this works out in the end as compared to knowing that if I'm a 30-year-old and I know I can put money into a retirement account that is tax-free for the next 40 years until I start taking out that money when I'm, you know, 70, I'd much rather do that knowing the history of the stock market and the growth of corporate America over time than I do on hoping that, you know, crypto makes me a zillionaire. So sure, if you want to take, you know, 5% max of your money and put it there, that's fine. But it's a gamble.
So let's wrap it up with a quick comment on the gold market, because this market's been pretty interesting post-Fed announcement, because gold did drop on the back of that Fed announcement, but it's gained something like $60 just from that announcement on Wednesday and is now just marginally above 1800. That has some of the gold bulls encouraged, but if you look at a longer-term chart, especially mostly for this year, it's been trending slightly lower and really just stuck around that 1800 level. Pretty boring market. What's your outlook for gold here as we head into next year?
Well, if we're going to talk about gold, you'll have to wake me up from the long sleep of what it's been like being in gold this year. It has not been an asset that's returned you anything, really. It's been a very, very quiet sideways market. So we came into the year at, I don't know, somewhere near, I think it was like 1900. And, you know, here we are just at 1800. So you've lost money in gold. And a couple of things here. So gold is typically the type thing you keep in your portfolio as a hedge against inflation, as a hedge against disaster. But with the S&P up, you know, 25%, give or take, for the year, not only have you lost a little money in gold, but whatever money you had in gold, you've lost the opportunity to make 25% if you were just, let's say, in a passive invested ETF of the spiders or something that represents the stock market. But the reason you're in gold in the first place is as a hedge. So similar to, I guess, what you want to say about Bitcoin now or cryptos, you know, it's an asset that essentially gives you some protection against downside, some protection against inflation. But the funny thing is, this year, with inflation being rampant and on the highest levels historically that we've seen, gold has done nothing. So perhaps it's lost its appeal on the, you know, as inflation protection. Now, you also have to take into consideration that the dollar has moved up this year, and a strong dollar is negative for gold. So a lot of the reason gold hasn't done anything this year is just how much the dollar's moved up. And, you know, it moved from 89 to 96 in the dollar index. It's over 7%, is a significant move for the dollar. And that is going to hamper the ability for precious metals, most especially gold, to rally. So there's, you know, gold has some headwinds that it's kind of faced, but inflation should have been a tailwind, and it's really done nothing. Short term, however, gold held where it needed to on the recent decline earlier this week, right around 1750. And as you say, it's right now front month futures are trading at 1805. So yes, it has bounced $60 or so from that low, and I actually like it very short term. I put on a long gold position for a fund I trade simply because I now have a very defined risk underneath Wednesday's low. If we break Wednesday's low, I get out of the trade. I lose, let's say, 2%. And I'm willing to put on a trade if I can keep loss to 2%. And on the upside, I'm probably not going to make a heck of a lot more than 2%. So risk-reward-wise, it's not great. But I do think the fact that gold held where it did gives me a minor bullish stance on gold for, trade up to 1850, something like that. So nothing big here. It's still within its range. And I don't know. The long-term fundamentals still say gold is bullish. But the gold market, it's what it's done in 2021 has been wholly unimpressive.
It really has been. It's been boring, but I guess yep. You're slightly encouraged. The problem is so many other markets have done better. And even on the other side, so many markets have shown more volatility, which does attract more traders in. So gold's kind of suffering on both of those fronts. Rick, great having you on the show, buddy. I've really enjoyed all of our conversations this year. I really appreciate all the time you spend with us. We'll be chatting in the new year. And hey, I hope you keep up your calls because they really have been spot on through most of this year. Rick, thank you. As always, buddy, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend and very happy holiday season.
Same to you, Corey. It's been a pleasure.